Okay, so I got recruited to lead this discussion on something. And I'll try and explain that something. And everyone is encouraged to participate. This is hopefully not at all a research topic, but a discussion. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's the topic of discussion? Well, over here is just some backgrounds, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. What a PDF is, mean, standard deviations, that sort of thing. But our real interest is this group of quantities here. And there's no real uniform definition of these things. Recurrence times, which has become sort of a hot topic in the physics literature last year or so, is basically the interval, if you have a characteristic event, let's say a characteristic earthquake. So you have a San Francisco earthquake, the time to the next San Francisco earthquake is the recurrence time. And the question is, what is that distribution, statistical distribution? And you can talk about that a lot. Inter-event times would be the times between all the earthquakes in an area. For example, in Southern California. Waiting times, that's the question of what's the statistical distribution of future San Francisco earthquakes. So the last one occurred 100 years ago. What's our expected statistic for the future? And I would call it delay time, something having to do with a phase change, fracture, something that's irreversible, something that ruptures. So you have repetitive quantities and non-repetitive quantities. Now,
there's another thing which seems, people talk about the San Francisco earthquake. Some people might have thought that there was an earthquake in 89, but apparently that one doesn't count.
That's,
so there's some concept that there's some characteristic largest event that you're talking about in all this, in February occurrence time. Right?
That particular earthquake is very debatable, because the question is, did it occur on the San Andreas Fault? And the general thought is that it did not occur on the San Andreas Fault, so therefore it's not included. It also occurred at the end of the lock section, so it was a transitional earthquake that you have tectonics with a bend in the fault just there. Now, the Parkfield sequence is much more well-defined, because there's no, at this point in time, there's no equivocation about the sequence of seven Parkfield earthquakes that have been, in essence. Okay?
There's some magnitude that's sort of drawn as a line, and it's only ones above that are counted, and whether that line is sort of...
Okay, I will talk about that.
Okay.
Specifically, right, because that's a very valid point. Okay, so, I mean, there's hundreds of distributions, but the ones I would like to concentrate on are the Poissonian exponential random distribution. This, as I'll say again, is characteristic of most so-called SOC systems. And therefore, SOC systems have been considered rather boring. Now, the stretched exponential appears very widely in this whole area. In the engineering literature, it is known as the Weibull distribution, and is used, this is a standard way to treat failure statistics in engineering, is to use Weibull. Now, the exponential shown here, you can derive it very easily from this little differential equation, basically a logistic equation, and you just integrate this and you get the Poissonian effect. This has no memory, etc., etc. The stretched exponential is almost identical, except that it has this power beta in here, and this is no longer the mean, but it's a two-parameter family with this. It can be derived using the same equation, except that we have a time dependence here. If you have a power law time dependence in here, you get the stretched exponential distribution. And of course, this reduces, when beta is 1, it reduces to this. Now, we can talk about earthquakes, Weibull or power law, and we can talk about fracture, we can talk about phase changes, we can talk about SOC problems, models, we can talk about time series, and I'm prepared to discuss each of these a bit, but I'm no expert on this stuff, so I welcome other discussions. Now, the question is, does the waiting time increase or decrease if you wait from the previous event? In other words, is the mean waiting time for a San Francisco earthquake today less than it was in 1906? It turns out that it's fairly obvious that if you have a Poisson distribution with no memory, the mean waiting time is constant in time. So that is the base reference distribution. So beta equal 1, no memory. If beta is greater than 1, the waiting time decreases. And this is why this has been widely used for earthquakes, particularly in Japan. And in Japan, this was derived basically using, back in the 70s, using this equation, where this is basically the increase in stress due to tectonics. And therefore, if you put beta here equal to 2, which is a Rayleigh distribution, then what you get is you get a linear increase in stress with time, and the Rayleigh distribution is a fair approximation to characteristic earthquakes, as we see as we go along. So you have basically, if beta is less than 1, this is a so-called fat tail distribution, so the waiting time increases. Phase changes are widely thought to satisfy the stretched exponential with beta between 0 and 1. In fact, that's known as Avrami's law and is used as a standard treatment of, say, boiler explosions. So there's a big use in chemistry, big use in engineering to get the statistical distribution, say, you release the pressure in a boiler, it explodes. How long does it take for it to explode? This is the type of problem that has been widely treated experimentally. So phase changes seem to fit that. Okay, so I would comment that there's always been a great dichotomy between statistical physicists. I'm an engineer by background, so I don't count myself as a physicist at all, and statisticians. Statisticians in general reject any power law distribution out of hand. It's not a statistical distribution. So they've always rejected fractals as a matter of principle. Statistical physicists routinely use power laws. I don't think they usually call them fractals, but they routinely use them. This kind of waiting time stuff is a key in statistics, because it's like telephone calls, interval between fires, all this stuff. So this stuff is standard statistics, but until the last couple of years, as far as I can see, it's not appeared in statistical physics. And what really started this renewal of interest was the paper by Perbach. And this appeared in 2002, and this has spurred very many. It's a branching process, and Perbach's paper was sort of the top of the branching process, and there's been a lot of branching. Perbach's paper is here, 2002, and I'll show you what that is. There's a whole bunch of papers that discuss this going on through here. Now, what is Perbach's paper about? I showed this when I talked a while ago, but it illustrates what it's about. So these are aftershocks of Parkfield earthquake in 2004, but he did it for all of California earthquakes. We've done that. You get the same results. And this is a this should be a small p, but it's not used uniformly by everybody. This is a histogram of the inter-event times, not the recurrence times. The inter-event times, you have the first earthquake, next aftershock, they're in different faults, for they're from all over. And basically, you do a histogram, and you get this, and he pointed out that you get universal scaling, etc. I won't go into that. But that led to an explosion of papers on this subject. And the thing about this is that it's very distinct from the characteristic earthquake problem. Now, for example, we get into the discussion here, and this was the previous, somewhat of the previous discussion. So there's been a great debate in the seismology literature for a long time about this. Does the hazard for the next earthquake increase or decrease with time? And that is crucial. Now, if you take the aftershock sequence, obviously the hazard decreases. If you, let's say you have a 6 earthquake, your chances of, say, a 4.5, if you haven't had it after 3 days, it continuously decreases. And so Corral, who's written a lot of papers on this subject in the last 2 or 3 years in the physics literature, points this out. But the whole literature having to do with characteristic earthquakes, that's not the way it is. And I'll show this for... So these are the famous Parkfield earthquakes, if you're familiar with these. The times they occurred here. The cumulative distribution functions here fit with a Weibull distribution, stretched exponential. You can't say you have great faith in this because you haven't got enough earthquakes. But the whole basis of the Parkfield earthquake experiment, which has cost taxpayers of this country, I don't know, Jim can correct me, but probably $30 million, something like that, maybe less than that. Five. Was on the basis that it was started in 85, so it was 20 years after this, and they put it in because they thought it was ready to occur. So the whole hypothesis was that you had a decreased waiting time. Now, it actually occurred in 2004. But it was based on a decrease in the waiting time. So you have to have a thin-tail distribution. So you cannot fit these recurrence intervals with, basically, you cannot fit them with a, for example, log normal distribution. Because a log normal distribution is a fat-tail distribution in the spirit, and the waiting time increases like a power law. Okay? Now, so, let's see. We carried out simulations, and this was a simulation on the Northern San Andreas Fault where we had 4,600 earthquakes. And this is basically an elasticity interacting fault simulation. But this sort of shows you need a lot of statistics to get something. And even then, you're binning, you know, you can't be sure that your binning is all that good.
So now, what are we looking at here? Now, can you just kind of explain what this data is and what the model is?
It's a PDF of the time between great San Francisco earthquakes. And this is virtual California.
Exactly repeating earthquakes or kind of plus or minus?
This is a great debate in terms of what's going to happen in the next assessment of earthquake probabilities in California. The question is, how do you do this?
That's what I'm asking. How did you do it here? That was
these are basically any earthquake with a magnitude greater than 7 that occurs in a segment of the fault which participated in the 1906 earthquake, period. Now, the question is, do you get small earthquakes in the San Andreas Fault in San Francisco? In my opinion, you don't get any small earthquakes, so they're all characteristic earthquakes, but that's debatable, right? Okay. Now I want to show the results of another simulation. The question is, what do you get for various simulations? Okay, so let's go over and look here. I would appreciate any contributions that anybody would like to make here. So, SOC models, and I'll come back to this because Karen is going to put in here. The interval times originally discussed by Perbach and most everybody else for forest fire, slider block, or the sandpile model was that the recurrence time was Poissonian. So that it wasn't very interesting. There's some deviations from that. Sometimes it will go into a power law if you tune things correctly. So that was one reason that this whole subject was not so considered particularly interesting at that point in time. Now, so let's go back a little bit and ask, what are the physics of time delays? And what are the physics particular of a variation in time delays? So, in my opinion, a time delay is easy to get. You just use a time delay equation. For example, slider blocks with rate and state friction, that gives you a time delay built into it because of just the onset of sliding. Static coefficient of friction in a certain way gives you a time delay. Now, there's also a time delay if you push the slider block above the static coefficient of friction, though because of rate and state friction, there's a time delay. But to get a variation in time delays for aftershocks, for example, you have to do something else. Now, you can get this variability by introducing a variability. That is, you can put in a stochastic input and get a variation, or you can basically get it from a chaotic system. So what I showed you there had no, for the San Francisco earthquakes, it had no, you can do that without a stochastic input. Sometimes you put it in, but you can do it without, and you'll get a variation in the, for example, a simple chaotic system will have a variation in events. Two slider blocks are a chaotic system, can be, and you can get variation. So chaotic behavior leads to this, or a stochastic input leads to this. These kinds of equations are basically a stochastic input by definition. Now, one thing we did to try and look at this, I mean, a lot of people are looking at these problems today. We made a forest fire model in which the fires occur only when you get a percolating cluster on a grid. So you plant trees until it percolates, there's a connected cluster, you burn it. You plant trees until you next burn it. So this is a way to get characteristic events. If you just have a forest fire model where you drop matches, you get a power law distribution of event sizes, and you get Poissonian statistics, whatever you do. Even over threshold, whatever, it's always Poissonian. But by introducing into the model this characteristic behavior, non-power law statistics, you can get a distribution which is well approximated by the stretched exponential, the Weibull, and is very similar in its behavior to the one I showed you for simulated San Francisco earthquakes. Okay, so I want to change the topic a little bit. And
if you take a model like a sand pile model, which is SOC and has all these power laws,
right,
and you introduce inertia, then you introduce some characteristic hysteresis, you get large events, and that would introduce some of this correlation like a large beta would. Has anyone looked at the statistics in that kind of model? We never talked about inertia, but I don't know if it's related to this. No.
Maybe related, but we didn't look at it.
Well, Ulami Feder Christensen model is a model in this class. It was a sort of a slider block model. It is a slider block model. And they looked at this. They looked at this problem, and by changing their tuning, in the way they introduce irreversible, they introduce dissipation, they were able to go from a Poissonian for some events to power laws. There's a big confusion. I mean, it's confusing to me because the literature you read in these physics papers are not self-consistent with each other. Some of them say that if you take a high threshold in SOC models, you can get power laws for the delayed times. But others say no, that it's just Poissonian. And it's not clear that very many studies have been carried out. Now,
can you talk about Weibull distribution, what exponent you're using?
Okay. These, let's see, here, 2.74.
And the earthquake one showed the exact sentences for
earthquake. It was also like 2.8, wasn't it?
Let's
see. The white field, I thought it was
2.8. Sigma over, well, you can, it's about, it's similar, okay? I don't have it sitting on this one.
The Parkfield one had
2.8. 2.8, yeah. Here's Parkfield, is 2.88. Here. And typically around 2 are used. Now, it's generally felt that we also got these results that the coefficient of variation, which is like beta, coefficient of variation decreases, beta goes up, coefficient of variation 0 gives you periodic, theta of infinity gives you periodic. On the big faults in California, you have a bigger value beta than you have on the secondary faults. And that's systematic in the models, and I think it's systematic from observations pretty much. So, yeah?
What do you call this a stretched exponential? Is it beta larger than
one? Stretched exponential can be beta of any value from 0 to infinity. Now, of Rami's law...
From me, it's beta smaller than 1.
There is a group that certainly uses that convention.
Well, then you can use, that's fine. You can use stretched exponential for less than 1 and beta for greater than 1, but it's certainly not standard in the literature.
In all the literature on glasses.
That's fine. And certainly in, of Rami's law is for beta less than 1, period. And but in rupture, beta is generally greater than 1. So, you know, you can, I agree with you. But there's no, you know, it's the same functional form. And one could introduce another name, but that's unstretched exponential or squeezed. Right. Okay, so this is another, this is another class of problems, and again, this is a group of the physicists have are writing papers on this. So, I've switched here to the fractional noises. Okay. I hope most of you know what fractional noises and fractional walks are. A white noise, of course, is just a sequence of, say, a Gaussian white noise is a sequence of values selected randomly from a Gaussian distribution. a fractional noise is a filtered. That is filtered, and this is an example of a filtered value. If you sum up a Gaussian white noise, you get a Brownian walk. And you can have fractional walks, which are the sums of fractional noises. If you add fractional noises, you get fractional walks. Fractional noises are stationary. Fractional walks are unstationary. Now, another characteristic quantity that I haven't listed here are crossing times. And if you talk about walks, say a Brownian walk, recurrence times are not of interest, but crossing times are. So a crossing time is you start out at this point, and how soon does the walk cross back over the original value? And that has a statistical value, and that's considered very important in economics. Now, here we have a fractional noise.
It's how long you have to wait until you've gained nothing.
Right. That's right.
Or lost nothing.
Or lost nothing. Right. Right. So, if you have a stationary noise, though, it has a well-defined mean and a well-defined standard deviation. And what appears in the literature, several papers have said this, and I still don't know whether it's right or not, but they basically, this is how you define a noise. This is a different beta, but it's a standard, and this is the, these are the Fourier coefficients in a Fourier spectrum, and if the values of the coefficients of the Fourier spectrum have a power law dependence, and beta is between 0 and 0.5. In this formulation, you have a noise. In the standard formulation, you use the power spectral density instead of f of x, which is the square of f of x. And this goes from 0 to 1. So that's between a white noise and a red noise, 1 over f noise. So these are noises between in that range. And the question is peaks over threshold. So this is where you get peaks over threshold. So you put a threshold in, and you get the interval time between peaks. Now this has lots of applications. It has applications in climatology, it has applications in floods, has lots of applications. And then the question is, what do you get? Well, these people assert, and as I say, as far as I can see, it's just an assertion, which they test, that you can define the autocorrelation function between two points with a delay built in. So the value at I and the value of I plus S. So this depends on the delay with a power law. So then they say that you get a true stretched exponential result in which the interval time distribution basically is a stretched exponential with gamma equal to this gamma. So gamma and gamma C are the same. So there's a direct correlation between the interval statistics and the autocorrelation function. And there have been a number of people who have basically, particularly Bundy, who have looked.
This is the same equations that we use for all the self-affine surfaces that we've been
Absolutely.
Talking about so far.
Absolutely.
And so this interval time is now just the time to be above some.
It's the distance from high peaks.
The distance between high peaks.
Statistical distance between high peaks. Right. Which, I'm not sure that's important.
If you have an interface, you can solve the problem, and you know that the distribution. It's not a stretched exponential, it's about a log exponent, which is 2 minus h, and h is the Hurst exponent. But I guess these are not
self-affine integrals. Yeah, this is essentially the same thing. I mean, the Hurst exponent is basically the Hurst exponent is directly related to this.
Wait, you have a power law?
The fact that you have a Hurst exponent means that this is directly related to the Hurst exponent. In fact, the Hurst exponent will fall between 0.5 and 1 in the same spirit that this will. And a Hirschf exponent is only good for noises. It's no good for walks. And is a quantification of exactly the same thing. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between this and a Hirschf exponent. So when you say Hirschf exponent, if there is one, this is what you've got. And this, and therefore, and you say this is what you see, stretched exponent.
Well, I would say no. I would say analytically, I think about the same thing. If you take a rough profile, so
right,
a fine profile, and then you ask, what is the distance? I put a line there.
Yep.
And I want to ask, what is the distribution of these returns? I mean, whenever
the peaks.
Whenever I hit the same peak.
That's exactly what we're talking about.
Okay, that's. As far as I know, it's a power law with an exponent, which is, I think, 2 minus h, but I may be wrong. So it's a power law.
I thought it might be 2 minus h over 2.
Over.
It's the same thing as the distribution of lake
yeah,
sizes.
Yeah, probably you're right.
But that's area. So,
there is a relation.
But that's sort of the time to get to the other side of the same
exactly.
peak, as opposed
exactly.
to the time to go below and to the next peak.
It's not to the next. Okay, of course. That's the distribution to go to the same, exactly the same
yeah.
level. No, you draw a line and you measure the different.
So that's if you will the length of the earthquake, as opposed to the time to the next
peak.
Earthquake, but so I could believe the stretch exponential, but I'm not familiar with the result.
Okay, that's fine. And that discussion comes into a lot of the stuff where you talk about the length of the duration of something versus the quiet time. So this. So this is basically this discussion having to do with solar flares. And the top paper, I don't know if you can see it, but the top paper looks at sand piles and basically argues that you can get both power laws and Poissonian statistics when you raise the threshold. And then they compare it with the solar flares and discussion of solar flares down here. So then they get into this question, are the power laws consistent with an SOC type behavior for solar flares? Again, I'm not in any way an expert on solar flares. Okay, so in essence, I just prepared a summary, and so the discussion's up to the rest of you. And Karen was going to lead it off.
Just give you one example case where we sort of stumbled over this in the context of magnets. And there actually is fairly straightforward to understand what's going on. So it leads sort of to one test in all of these systems that you can apply. What we were studying is dipole moment and magnets. So if you have a magnetic material and you apply a field, then basically as you ramp up the field, you have these magnetic domains that flip in the direction of the field. And so if one domain flips from down to up, it can trigger neighboring domains to also flip, so you get an avalanche of spin flips. So actually it turns out that there is a nice connection between the model that we wrote down for these avalanches and magnets and earthquakes. So on long length scales, actually, they flow. They have the same scaling behavior, these two, the earthquake model and this magnet model. But let's stick to the magnets for right now. So basically what we did is we said, well, now let's introduce this order into the system. So you say, you know, usually you don't have a clean material, you have a disordered material. So you say, actually what we did is we used the zero temperature random field Ising model, where you say each spin is coupled ferromagnetically to the nearest neighbors. It's coupled to the external field, and then at each side of the lattice, there's also a random field, which varies randomly from side to side. Okay, and these random fields are taken from a Gaussian distribution, right? Gaussian distribution of random fields. So you put those random fields down. They're quenched. They stay fixed, and then you start with a very negative external magnetic field. That means all your spins to begin with, they're all pointing down. And then you slowly raise the field, and then you say each spin flips when the local effective field at that side, the local field, which is the interaction with the neighboring spins, plus the random field, plus the external field. When that goes from down to up, the spin flips. So if you have an arrangement like this, you might guess as you slowly raise this external field, you'd say, oh, this one will be the first one to flip because it has a very high field, and then it triggers the neighbors and it starts a cascade. Anyways, I'm just sort of want to get everybody on the same ground here about this model or about the system that we're talking about. Anyways, so if you now model the system for a very narrow distribution of random fields, basically you have no random field at all, as you slowly raise the field, what happens, they all keep each other down until finally your external field overcomes the interaction with the neighbors and everybody flips. So you get one huge avalanche. If you have very high disorder, then basically the disorder is much more important than the coupling to the neighbors, so you get mostly small avalanches. And in between these two regimes, there is a critical amount of disorder where disorder and coupling sort of just balance. It doesn't know quite, do I have large or small events? So you get avalanches of all sizes. So let me just real quick. So if you, for example, you can also look at the hysteresis curves in this model, which would be plotting your magnetization versus field. So at low disorder, you have a very square hysteresis loop. At high disorder, you have a very smooth hysteresis loop. And in between, you have a critical disorder. And these avalanches that I'm talking about are really steps in the magnetization. So at low disorder, when R is basically zero, you have a huge step that corresponds to the avalanche that sweeps through the entire system. At high disorder, you have mostly small events that corresponds to, so the steps are mostly small. And in between, at a critical disorder, if you do a histogram of your avalanche sizes, you get a power law distribution. So that's sort of a phase transition point. Anyways, so and then you have scaling near this critical disorder. Now you can ask those same type of questions. You can say, all right, let's say we're sitting near this critical disorder where I have a power law distribution of these avalanche sizes. So in a Barkhaus noise experiment, what you would do is you would wrap, you take your magnetic material here, you'd wrap a search coil around it, hook it up to a voltmeter, and then as you slowly raise the field, you would measure the induction pulses from the spin flips. So you would measure the voltage as an output. So if you now plot this voltage as a function of time as you slowly raise the field, you get these avalanches of spin flips. And now you can ask the question, how do these, for example, how do the nucleation times of these avalanches, what is the distribution of the nucleation times, or what is the distribution of these time intervals between avalanches? And just like these other models that Don mentioned that have power scaling, in this case, in this simple model, you would just get a Poisson distribution because it's totally random. The nucleation points for these avalanches are just given by your random distributions, your distribution of random fields, so it's a Poisson distribution for these nucleation times. Okay, now what you can do is, and actually Stefano did a lot of very nice work on that, you can add long-range forces to this model. In magnets that plays a role, you have these long-range anti-ferromagnetic or these long-range dipolar interactions in addition to the nearest neighbor coupling. Okay, so for magnets, that's actually important to add those. In soft magnets, those play a big role. So you can add them, and then Stefano and collaborators, they showed that that these long-range interactions are actually so long-range that mean field theory, where you make them infinite range, gives you the correct scaling behavior in the physical dimension. So basically, what you can say is, let's add these long-range forces. In that case, what happens is the dynamics so far in this model with this Poissonian distribution of these wave times, I have allowed spins to flip anywhere in the bulk. So basically, you can have the nucleation of domains of up spins, you know, anywhere in the bulk. But if you add these long-range forces to the problem, then basically, most of your avalanches end up coming from a single domain wall that's propagating. And this also ties into work that Mark Robbins talked about, I think a couple of weeks ago, that they did on a domain wall propagation in a magnet. Except in this case now, there is this added long-range interaction. So now, so basically now, if this is your magnet, and now say you raise the field, this is the direction of the applied field. You raise the field, you can ask again, if I now have wrapped a search coil around it, again I measure the voltage as a function of time as I raise the field, and I look at the distribution of the wave time distribution, say between avalanches. You can ask, what is it in that case? And it turns out, there's some preliminary experiments from Gianfranco Durin in Torino, where he found that those are basically parallel distributed. It turns out in this case also, and Stefano showed this, in that case you get actually the system, because of these long-range anti-ferromagnetic interactions, the system basically operates at a depending point. So you get parallel distribution of avalanche sizes. So basically, without the long-range forces, you would have a depending transition for this interface. You would have to raise your field until it starts to slide. That's what Mark Robbins talked about the other day. But if you add these long-range forces, what happens is the system tends to operate near this depending transition. So if you would plot the velocity of the domain wall as a function of the applied field or force, then with the long-range force, it tends to operate near this depending point, and therefore you get parallel distributions of these avalanche sizes. So now you can ask yourself, can we understand where this parallel distribution of these waiting times comes from in this case? And the answer is yes, you can. Because if you say there is an avalanche happening here, usually this avalanche, if you have only nearest neighbor interactions, has no effect on the field, when you would actually start an avalanche over here, because that's far removed from this avalanche. But if you have these long-range anti-ferromagnetic forces, then an avalanche happening over here, say, if you use this mean field argument, you can say this avalanche then will reduce the effective field over here by an amount that's proportional to the size of this avalanche, right? Because you have these anti-ferromagnetic forces, so each spin that flips up here reduces the effective field, which is the sum of the interactions plus everything else, by a certain amount. So the more avalanches flip here, the more you reduce the field over here. So then in order to trigger an avalanche over here, you will have to work against this reduction of the effective field from the previous avalanche. So in other words, you have to raise your external field by an amount in order to trigger the next avalanche. You have to raise your field by an amount that would be bigger, the bigger the previous avalanche was, because you're basically working against this reduction of the external field. So in other words, it's this it's no wonder that this distribution of wait times until the next avalanche starts is given basically by the distribution of avalanche sizes. The way to test this, when you have a parallel distribution of these wait times, whether this parallel distribution of wait times between avalanches is actually due to such an effect, would be to look at whether there's a correlation between a previous avalanche and the wait time till the next avalanche. So that would be, in these systems with these parallel distributed wait times between events, it would be nice to see, is there a correlation, if I have a size S1 here, between the size of this avalanche and the wait time till the next avalanche happens?
And in particular, if you focused on that one avalanche, mm-hmm. I would expect that you might find that the distribution, in fact, had very low probability for a big avalanche immediately following and then rising. I mean, it's not obvious that you can't even have a waiting time, a resting time or something that I've heard about for these other problems, just because you have to wait for the field to build back up, so there'd be some decorrelation.
Right.
All these equations over here, the probability is sort of is decaying.
Right.
So.
Right. Right. Well, I guess in this case. right. Okay. So far, I haven't said anything about correlation between sizes of subsequent events.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, in this model, I don't think there is a correlation.
But if you say you looked at the spanning ones, I mean, there's
look
at the really big ones in any finite size system,
mm-hmm.
there will be events that are comparable to the system size.
Right.
And I bet that if you looked at those as your big quakes and you said, how long will it be to the next one, that it would be there'd be no chance of having another spanning avalanche right away, just because there's not energy in the system.
Yes, that's
and
correct.
And so you'd have to wait some time. So the probability would be sort of zero.
Yes.
And then grow, and there'd be some sort of typical time, which is the time for the field to build the energy back up. And I think that seems to be something that has to be going on in these earthquake systems.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, actually, Garrett and Don and I were just looking at this model that Yehuda has been talking about a lot. You know, there's this earthquake model where, and Garrett talked about it in his talk also, where you have mm-hmm. this fault, and this is the one that actually has the same scaling behavior as this the main model. So you have this fault, and you drive it from far away. And basically, you can look at the stress distribution. So basically, you have these cells that slip as you load it, and you have so then you can look at the distribution of stresses across the fault. And so basically, what they've been doing is sometimes they introduce this dynamic versus static friction. So if you have static friction, then basically your threshold is high. You reload the system. You have a threshold for sliding for a cell, and for static friction, basically that threshold is fixed. But if you allow for dynamic friction, so basically when a cell slides in the next step, during an earthquake, the threshold is reduced to a dynamic value, and you have something like static versus dynamic friction, then you can ask yourself, how does the stress distribution across the fault look? And after a large event, you have a stress distribution that is all these stresses across the fault are basically relaxed.
Right.
So here's the static threshold, but all the stresses of all the cells are all the cells have a stress that's lower than the dynamic value after a system assessment. And it takes a while, you know, to reload it until this whole system gets back to this threshold again and starts the next event. And so, so you can actually calculate what that probability distribution is.
Right, and so instead of the probability of a waiting time sort of dropping, you can imagine that the probability of the waiting time actually is zero, and the next event would be at a well peak.
Right.
And we know of a very good example of this in stick slip motion, which is violin strings. I mean, if you take a violin moving across a string, it's slipping at exactly the frequency that we hear, right? And that's the whole design of the violin, is to make it a very, very precise, narrow thing here. And if you screw around and use the wrong rosin, you don't get a nice sharp frequency and it sounds flat. So there's an example of earthquakes, right, which are all of a large event and have a very well-defined waiting time with a very large cue. And looking at this, I can't help but seeing a very different simple explanation of this fit of this data. To me, that looks like a straight line. And so I can fit that by that for the probability distribution, where there's zero up to some point and then it's flat. And of course the statistics are not good enough to distinguish between that picture and this picture. And so for these big earthquakes, it seems the fundamental issue is just this question of, if you look at the total energy as a function of time, if you have something where the big event releases a lot of energy, so much of the energy stored in the surrounding system of the elastic plates, okay, that there isn't enough left to have a big earthquake, then it's physically impossible to have another earthquake until you've waited long enough for the stress to build back up. And so I guess then the question would be, if we know for regions of the San Andreas Fault whether you're getting stick slip where the big faults are releasing most of the stored energy in the plates, or whether you're having something else which you can see in stick slip motion on the lab scale, where the total energy is doing this and you're only releasing perhaps a small amount of the total kinetic energy in the system. Typically, this kind of behavior tends to be observed when the spring that's driving the system is very weak compared to the interfacial strength. But I think if you've got coefficients of friction of 0.6 and things, that probably you're necessarily in this regime where you're losing most of the energy.
I disagree with your last statement. Okay. I think it doesn't matter what the spring stiffness is as long as it's below some critical level.
For which case? For
the amplitude of the stress drop is independent of the spring stiffness. But the stress drop is independent.
I think it may depend upon the exact form of your friction weakening law.
If for simple laws, it's independent.
It's only the static dynamic friction that determines it.
Right.
No, but if you make it stiffer than 1/2 the system size, then you don't allow for large events because you're
okay. He's plotting stress, yeah. not slip. This is stress, not slip.
Well, what I
so stiff springs put energy there. The same stress
but so you're saying that for sufficiently weak springs and no inertia. Inertia can also screw things up.
Not much.
The question is, are you talking about one block? That's the question. Karen, I think, is talking about connector springs and all this stuff. That's not, you can't mix connector springs, because Jim is talking about one block, I think.
I don't think it matters. You can do a continuum and with a propagated crack, and you can put in unity for stiffness and scale any stiffness you want, and the stress drop will change. The fractional
static friction. Well, this normally corresponds to the static friction. This can be lower than the kinetic friction, depending upon.
But not more than twice the difference if it's simple.
It can go negative depending upon the system and laboratory experiments. I mean, that depends upon the specifics. It may be lightly loaded, but
you have to be a really complex loading system
Jacob Israeli has seen it in those systems. Those may be single stars.
The normal stress is constant and it's consistent. But I think the pertinent question is not arguing about this little detail. It's which of those two you have in nature.
Right.
And the answer is we don't know. And that's what people kind of debate about continuously. And this new class of models that Jim Rice has been advancing and talked about at the kickoff conference we had was really models for the uppercase in part, where you can have extreme weakening of the fault, right? You know, the sliding friction isn't, you know, 9/10 of the static friction, it's 1/10 of the static friction. In that case, then, yeah, you know, you would certainly expect the argument to hold. There's not enough energy left in the system. I think.
So then there has to be a dead time where the probability is identically zero before you.
But this is a hotly debated topic, you know, and you'll find there's a lot of different views on this. Because I think a lot of people hold the lower picture to be more realistic, and things can happen which would kind of alter the system slightly and allow you to keep dropping the stress. There's less energy left.
Mark, could you expand on your comment that inertia is important?
If you imagine the toy model that illustrates it, which may or may not be realistic, is this. So we imagine that we have a sphere being pulled in a potential. And we imagine we've got some spring that's doing the pulling, okay? Now, we know that if there's no inertia, if it's purely overdamped, then once we pull it enough to get over this barrier, become mechanically unstable and pop to the next minimum, it'll just go to the next minimum and it will stop. However, if we have a completely undamped system, then once we've got enough energy stored in the system, right, it will get accelerated and it will have enough velocity to carry it over this next peak. And in fact, it can now sort of spring all the way to the other side and go down to an amount equal to the opposite of this peak value.
But your toy model, what goes for sliding friction here is zero.
Because I have no dissipation, it's hard to know what the kinetic.
Well, just put a vertical axis on that drawing you just made.
The average force from the substrate is zero.
Yeah.
And so yes, in that limit, the kinetic friction would be strictly zero, but I'm still going to. It's twice the difference between the two. Okay,
so on that plot there, you can go to twice the sliding, to sliding friction over, the stress drop can be twice the difference between static.
Yeah,
and
assuming
friction,
that there's no different mechanisms
in these experimental apparatus where you have large stress drops. So we have a coupling between the shear and normal stress. So the normal stress is dropping continuously. And since we have a coefficient of friction, that means the sliding resistance is dropping continuously. So you can get all kinds of complicated things going on. But in the continuum, yeah, with a roughly cleaner fault, normal stress is constant, symmetry equals.
It's not obvious that in a real fault, you're not getting a lot of fracture and other stuff that's completely changing.
I make a conjecture about those two NM cases. I think nature's exactly in a critical state in between the two, just based upon some simulation results that I'll be showing.
Whether
you're having these little fluctuations in SOC or whether you're having these big quasi-periodic events, right? I think we're exactly in the middle at some critical state. And if you play with, and I'll show you this, two parameters on CN model, time, and this goes back to also what Karen was talking about, in between these hysteresis curves where you've got some critical one, that you end up with getting power law statistics of events at exactly some critical threshold between the two. You're going to get an overabundance of large events in that one. You're going to get something that's either power law statistics or with a roll-off at large event sizes in that case, and you're going to get perfect Gutenberg Richter in the middle. And I reckon, based upon some of the kinds of results I'll show, it's just conjecture. I think we're at some critical state in between those two amendments.
What's the
tuning? Well, tuning will be some system parameter. You know, it could be dissipation, it could be frictional parameters, it could be something else, some tuning parameter of the system.
So, Karen, for you, it was the width of the distribution of Gaussian for the magnetic field.
In the magnet model, in the earthquake model, I think it's the amount, the difference between static versus dynamic friction.
But there's no heterogeneity.
Yeah, there is, but heterogeneity, as long as that.
So heterogeneity can also be changed, or can also be changed. So this is to tune the distance from criticality.
You actually needed the heterogeneity to get a Mohr's law.
Yes.
It's a critical.
This is another reason for heterogeneity, but you can also tune the heterogeneity to move through the parameter space and approach criticality or go away from criticality. And to move between this truncated Gutenberg-Richter law and, for example, characteristic earthquake law. Can tune the heterogeneity, or you can tune what Karin said, this distance between static and kinetic friction.
Karen, when you said that with the long range interactions you operated on that dependent transition, did that mean that
there's no tuning?
There was no tuning, that's what I want to get at. There was no tuning in the long range case?
This is actually Stefano's issue that you answered. Go ahead.
Well, the polar force is at a strength and use the tuning parameter. And basically, this sets up how far you are from the in average from the beginning transition. So if you look at this avalanches, basically, this demagnetizing factor is a sort of spring stiffness that tells you how much you slip, basically.
So there was a different tuning parameter.
Different tuning parameter, but the critical point is when this parameter is tuned to zero. That's the difference, not to FC or something. So it's but this is the same also in Bach Sandfly mode. You can map it also there. You have the same kind of tuning parameter. Such that you have to tune the dissipation rate to zero. And the dissipation rate comes from the fact that you only throw away grains on the boundary, not everywhere. So since the boundary is much less than the bulk, this goes to zero naturally. But still, it's always the same mechanism.
But I guess ultimately, I guess the answer is yes, right? So
yes.
And then if you make the long range forces weak, like scale like 1/1 the system size or something, then the disorder itself, that was your question, right? If the disorder is tuning parameter,
okay, was that your question? Well, I understand when you didn't have the long range forces, that disorder was a tuning parameter,
right.
But then you said it.
In this case, no.
If you're in the
regime that Mark Robbins talked about, where without the long range forces, you have self-defined domain motion, basically. You don't have overhang. So anywhere in that regime, any disorder, then disorder doesn't matter what value of disorder you have. The long range forces put you right to that depending point, and you get the same critical, the same power law, no matter what disorder you have in that range. Right? Is that right? Yeah.
Even systems that have this kinetic friction 90% of the static one, you can get very periodic motion with very well-defined in the laboratory, right?
Oh, yeah. That's the norm.
And that may be because there's not enough internal degrees of
you're not at a big enough length scale that you've got the ability for dynamic chaos to set up in the fall. So is the thought that that's why, even that in an earthquake it might be different than the typical small scale laboratory setup, and you could get more than one big event nearby?
I think so.
Okay.
Myself, and of course, you know, I'm harping on the notion that there's not a single fault that's working either. It's this whole system of things coming in from all different directions and different sizes. But yeah, that's certainly.
But it's pretty.
I think about it. I don't know. That Don may have a different view on this, but that's how I think about it. Is that, you know, in fact, when we do the to do the experiments, a measure of a good experiment is how well we've got the system tuned in a different way, so that we get really repeatable events. Then we know we're kind of eliminating a lot of extraneous effects.
So then you have more or less the Gaussian distribution of waiting time centered on some time.
But certainly segmentation can lead to the complexity, and whether it's any kind of segmentation, and then it's even more complicated if you have interacting faults. But even the San Andreas with different segmentations leads to this stuff I showed you. And that's the same thing, because they have a planar model. You have a planar model, and by roughing it, you can get basically chaotic behavior, SOC, or whatever you want to, tuned behavior. But on the other hand, you make it absolutely smooth, you're going to get absolutely periodic earthquakes, right?
Yeah, I propose some results regarding the problem which we had with this recurrence times for smooth and rough folds if you have 2 minutes
Very short, because this question here during my talk.
But normally, have you used this before? Normally, that's what you do.
Are the switches from the computer to the beamer?
Yeah, it's supposed to.
Maybe
you have to read it. It may be under Linux that it doesn't.
Usually it works, I don't know.
If it's Linux, then don't bother trying.
I'm just turning around, we'll see from here.
I don't know how that works.
The figures are relatively crude and
turn it around.
Yeah.
And total correlation here.
So yeah, perhaps those who were in the talk remember here this
just on top of the
Can you sketch it on the chart?
Remember this this blocks for inter
for recurrence times of main shocks in this fold model of a 2D fold in a 3D elastic half space, and we had one end-member case, which was the smooth fold, where we had relatively regular occurrence of main shocks, sometimes some deviations, but in general very regular. And we had a disordered fold, where we have relatively irregular occurrence of main shocks.
Just one question I have on the we start with the homogeneous stress view. Is your initial conditions homogeneous stress?
The initial conditions are more or less random, and are the system evolved for.
You've got some model, you're shearing your stress beam, whatever way you're stressing it. Yeah. Initially, you start with zero stresses and homogeneous stresses, or what?
Initially, I start with random stresses, and the heterogeneities are, for example, here the stress drop. So it's a quantum spatial disorder in terms of stress drop. And the initial conditions are not really important if I have a system evolved for a long enough transient period.
Well, sometimes it can be, but it has one way to know if you have random stresses or homogeneous stress.
Okay, and we had here this, so this was rough, and we had the question about the recurrence times for both cases, and these were simulations over 1,000 years. And the problem is again the statistics, because we have here, I try to compute the recurrence time statistics, and we see that we have not enough main shocks, and this looks very noisy, and cannot clearly see anything because.
But you're not able to get any really long times. It looks like there's a sharp sort of cutoff beyond.
Yes, there were long times. There is.
I see, there's a few that are way out there.
In this case, the longest time is, in this case, it's over 60 years, and we have here the peak at about 22 years. And you have some kind of tail here on the right-hand side. But, the next, to improve this a little bit, I have changed to what I call a minimal model, to make the model very simple so that we can run very long simulations and get thousands of main shocks. What I have done, I have decreased here the cell size by a factor of 4. We had the original model 128 times 32, and now we have 64 times 16. The next point is I've taken out the most complex, from a numerical point of view, most complex mechanism, the creep motion, where we have to solve a system of differential equations numerically. Consequence is that we have in this minimal model no aftershocks and no foreshocks. And we have only tectonic loading and cosines mixed stress transfer, and as I said, quenched spatial disorder, which has been introduced as usual, or as I explained in my talk, we use here this barriers of high stress drop, which are embedded in an environment of low stress drop. And I've again considered two end member cases here, the heterogeneous fold with a certain amount of barriers and a relatively smooth fold where we have only Gaussian or it's white noise around a certain value. And
so then you have some average value with a small white noise.
Average value and some random numbers around this.
Which is small value. Compared to the mean.
Yes.
In the weak case, and in the strong case?
So in this case here, we have, in the case of the smooth fold, we have delta tau between 30 and 40 bars, and in the rough fold, we have delta tau for in this barriers between 90 and 100 bars, and this is perhaps 20 around 25 bars. 25 bars. I have adjusted this one so that we get the same average stress.
And how much is the static versus dynamic? I'm confused. The delta tau is the width of your.
We have here the static value, then we have the dynamic value, and then we have the test stress.
Okay.
And delta tau is difference between tau s and tau a, and tau d is determined by the dynamic overshoot coefficient, which is empirical value here of 1.25,
okay.
And this is the ratio of, I think this is tau s minus tau r divided by tau d minus tau r. I'm not quite sure, but I think this is the equation which determines tau d.
Tau d?
So, and then we get quite different time series. So these are again simulations over 1,000 years. And you see, as pointed out before, in the case of the smooth fold, we have a very regular occurrence of earthquakes. So it's I'm sorry, it's hard to see. So I can make a sketch. So the stress would really look almost periodically like this, and so the mean stress on the fold and the earthquakes, we have some small one, then a main shock, then we have a period of quiescence because the fold is exhausted, and then we have again this behavior on a smooth fold, and on a rough fold, this looks again more disordered. So this is in principle what you see here, these sequences. Yeah, and then I have computed here this recurrence time distribution for a larger number of main shocks, and we see that for the smooth fold, this looks at least relatively similar to a viable distribution. So with this exponential tail here, and this is very peaked here around a certain time for this periodic case, and I can look at the parameters. So we have gamma, which was here beta, is around 1.6. And yeah, we have a very small value of the coefficient of variation. And we see in the case of the rough fold, the distribution looks broader, and especially it has a second peak, which seems a little bit strange. So this looks like this, and so this looks not so similar to this stretched exponential functions, and what's next? And the reason for this is, it's in principle
front in these barriers on this type of heterogeneity.
Can you say how are you choosing what you're calling a main quakes so that, I mean, are you using things only bigger than some magnitude to define these recurrence times?
So we have here prepared to some degree the best conditions for a characteristic earthquake distribution.
Okay, so you have some maximum size.
Here, this is, here the red curve is, for example, for the smooth fold, and this is a quite good characteristic earthquake distribution. And
so you just take the ones on that peak.
Okay, this peak here has been taken. And even in the case of the rough fold, we have some kind of characteristic earthquake distribution. But we see here the red curve is the smooth fold, and this shows here clear characteristic earthquake distribution. And in the case of the rough fold with the barriers, we have here also similar to this recurrence time distribution, two peaks here at the end, which is which is a result of the disorder, and of course, to some extent, a result of the resolution of the grid. Because if we, I can draw here a rough fold. So this is the direction along strike, and this is depth. We have here these barriers which go from the surface to the depths. Then we have similar to the smooth fold here the peak. We have similar to the smooth fold the peak for the characteristic earthquake, which is here suppressed. And we have a second peak, which comes from this segmentation of the fold. Because if we have this very discontinuous form of heterogeneities, then these patches between the barriers can somehow be considered as fold segments. And we get, in principle, characteristic earthquakes for each patch. Or we get one peak is the same as in the case of the smooth fold, but it's suppressed, and we have here in this case a second pronounced peak, which may be this one here.
So they could be northern and southern California, for example.
I think this is about 100 kilometers, so it's even smaller. And this. So this is one more argument that that this degree of disorder can be used as a tuning parameter for the approach to criticality. It tunes the frequency size distributions, and it also tunes recurrence time distribution. If we would take a very large fold with a high resolution and make it very heterogeneous, then we would end up here in a good Gutenberg-Bechdel distribution with a broad scaling range, and these small peaks here for the single characteristic events would probably vanish. And in this case, I would expect that that the recurrence time distribution would be very broad. But in this case, it's difficult to define something like to define a characteristic event. But somehow, preliminary result is that in the case of the smooth fold, we get a distribution which looks at least similar to such a stretched exponential function, and in the case of more disordered and rough folds, it becomes more complex. And the underlying
quantity is probably this range of psi scales here, which is determined by the type and by the degree of heterogeneity. So that's only some appendix to the question during my talk.
Okay. People hungry? What? Call it a day?